right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. And now back to the oil and energy sector, chatting with Dan Steffens, president of the Energy Prospectus Group. Dan, I was looking through my notes from our last call, which happened February 26th. And one of the key discussion points, the first key discussion point, was oil prices were rebounding, driven by geopolitical tensions in Iran. This was 2 days before the U.S. started firing missiles into Iran and completely changed that oil chart price. Quite frankly, the chart was continuing to trend lower. Yes, we had a little bit of a rebound when we last talked, but now price recently spiked up to $120 a barrel. That's for crude. It's back now down into the high 80s, low 90s region. And the big question is, how long will the oil price stay at these higher levels? The forward curve is starting to come up, and a lot of that deals with the Strait of Hormuz and how long that will be shut down. Dan, what are you hearing? What are you seeing in terms of the potential of these oil prices remaining higher, let's say in the high 80s or even up to the hundreds?
Yeah, well, I mean, on the day we're recording this, obviously, we're just a few days into Trump's deal to not attack their power plants. Now, we're still attacking. Yesterday, we bombed hundreds of military sites, and Israel and Iran are exchanging. So the war hasn't stopped. There's no ceasefire. But they say now the near-term goal is to have a 30-day ceasefire. But the questions I have to have is, who in the hell in Iran has the power to even control a ceasefire, to get their military to back off? I don't know. It just seems like the thing's totally out of control right now. But it's going to be headline-driven. But I want to remind everybody, this is not the same as when Russia invaded Ukraine and all these sanctions against Russia. There was no physical supply of oil taken off the market. There was sanctions, but they were not enforceable, all this other stuff. This is a real loss of supply. Every day that the Strait of Hormuz is closed, we are losing 15 to 18 million barrels per day of supply. And if the war ends, that's not just going to magically show up in a storage tank someplace. It's going to take weeks, if not months, to get everything in the supply chain. And oil is the most important supply chain on Earth. You know, there are nations that if they don't have their oil supply, their economy is just shut down. And you need diesel to plant food, crops, to harvest them and stuff like that. I mean, it's really, really critical. And every day we're going further, deeper and deeper into tightening the oil market, and it's just not going to rebalance and we were talking before, and I said, I personally believe that every day the Strait of Hormuz is shut down, and I do think two or three a day are going through it or something, but that's, you know, nothing compared to the 100 or so that go through every day. And every day that adds another week to the recovery time. So if this goes 30 days, and I think there's no chance that, in my opinion, that this ends before the end of March. And I don't know what the terms of the ceasefire, if the terms of the ceasefire is they have to immediately open up the Strait of Hormuz, that might have a reaction in the oil market. But I still say this has created a big deficit. I mean, I've been in this industry for 50 years, and this is a really big shock to the supply and demand fundamentals.
Yeah, Dan, such a good point. It's such a different situation than the 2022 Ukraine situation. But to that point, and because of the amount of time it's going to take to get things ramped back up, are you surprised by the forward curve not having adjusted up more than it has? We just rolled over futures contracts. Are you surprised that we're not at even a higher level, that we're not at triple digits already, all things considered?
Yeah, when you look at the futures curve, and somebody explains to me, if you look at it and it looks like a wave, it looks like the front of the curve is high and then it drops off. So think of that as the crest of the wave. When you roll over, like we just rolled over from the April contract to the May contract, that wave will bring the May contract up as the longs then shift their positions into the next few months or something. And unless there's a settlement to the war, I think that wave just keeps growing, and it's not going to really show up in any inventory reports, because think about it, from the U.S. standpoint, it takes a tanker like 2.5 to 3.5 months to go from the Persian Gulf to the United States. Now, we don't import much oil from the Middle East anymore, but it just really will not start showing up in physical oil storage until we get to like May, and then it could be drastic if it's still going on. So we'll see. But I personally think the right price for oil today is over $70 a barrel. If this goes on into April, I think the right price will be over $80 a barrel. And, you know, these companies that I follow, our Sweet 16, our top large companies, they all made money. They were all free cash flow positive, and oil averaged, WTI averaged $59 for the quarter. So at 70, all that profit goes to the bottom line, and they're going to be very, very profitable. So we'll see. But all these companies are really not trading anywhere close. If oil does settle at 70, I would say across the board, the good upstream companies have 30 or 40% more upside in them.
So before we get more into the stocks, and we have a lot of questions on the stocks, quick comment on natural gas. Natural gas isn't really doing anything. It's, as I'm seeing it, just under $3. Any chance that natural gas plays a little catch up, is impacted at all by this war?
Well, the thing to remember, we're looking at, you know, natural gas prices in Canada and the U.S. The North America is blessed to have abundant supplies. We have more than enough surplus. We don't export enough yet, really, to get too much impacted by the global prices. Now, natural gas prices in Europe and in Asia, like we're paying $3 here in the U.S. now, they're paying $20 for gas. Asia the other day was up to 22 or 23. Asia is going to be the most impacted by the damage done in Qatar to those big gas fields there. And Qatar's told the world it's going to take 2 or 3 years to repair what's been damaged by the Iranian attacks. So this is not a couple months thing. This is a year thing. Now, this is super bullish for Canada and U.S. LNG exporters, because our LNG export demand will remain very high. I mean, just a few months ago, I was getting notes from people saying, oh, I see all this LNG being developed all the world. There's going to be a glut of supply in 3 years. Well, you can kiss that goodbye. It's, you know, maybe in 10 years there will be. But a lot of economies, especially Europe and Asia, they depend on natural gas, and not just for heating and electric power generation, but for the petrochemicals that they get out of it, that they make things out of. So it's a big deal. Now, right now, natural gas, I look at it, it's seasonal. It is seasonal. And April and May are the lowest demand periods for natural gas. Now, once the real summer heat kicks in, then we start firing up all these. We have what they call dedicated seasonal, I call them seasonal natural gas power plants. They only run in the summer to generate electricity for air conditioning demand down here. And when those things start ramping up, then that really creates another period of demand. But we're right now in what they call kind of the shoulder period. You're going to see some big gains to storage. Now, this tomorrow, on Thursday, on the 26th, EIA is going to announce a much larger than normal draw from storage for the week ending March 20th. That should get a little bit of attention. But we're going to end March with gas and storage in the U.S. just slightly above the five-year average. Now, that's based on the five-year average going backwards. Well, the five-year, we use so much more. Demand for U.S. gas is like 20, 25 BCF higher than it was per day, you know, 5 years ago. So when you start measuring it on days of demand, and another thing that's going to really, if you look at the strip for natural gas, the December futures contract is over $4 and the January 27 contract is over $5 this morning. And so everybody sees this, EIA sees this, everybody sees this situation happening, that we may have trouble refilling storage, because Golden Pass, it's Exxon and Qatar are partners on Golden Pass down in Louisiana. And when it comes online, it is adding another 2 billion cubic feet a day of export capacity. And the U.S. will be, by fourth quarter, we should be at about 22 billion cubic feet a day of export capacity, and which is like four BCF a day higher than it was the year before. So we're going to have much higher demand during the next winter heating season. And that's why, if you look at the strip, it's high in the winter months for next winter already. So they'll be fine. Hang on to your gassers, I tell them. And they're profitable. $3 gas, they're profitable.
Well, Dan, just all things considered, considering the spread between Europe and North America, and especially Asia and North America, and all these LNG export terminals, are there any companies that you can think of that specifically benefit from that spread, either as the energy company or the oil service company?
Well, on the upstream companies, they'll all benefit from that eventually. But EQT has real good sales contracts, and they they've got there's several LNG export facilities being built where they're going to be the primary source of their gas for those big export facilities. And EQT is like the second largest gas producer in the U.S. Antero has very good contracts already in place where they're selling down into what they call the Tier 1 area in South Louisiana, where there's some really big LNG export facilities, and they get a premium for that gas that they can get there. And it's like 70 or 80% of their gas gets into that region. So they look good. And on the LNG tanker, I like Flex LNG. That symbol FLNG pays a really nice dividend. And it has a very modern tanker fleet for LNG. They're tankers for LNG.
All right, Dan, let's go into the oil stock. Something that I was chatting with you about before recording this is that I had actually moved a fair bit of my portfolio, not an insignificant amount, into some energy stocks about a month and a half ago. I sold out of some of my precious metals and went into energy stocks, and some of them have done very well, but one stands out to me that has really lagged. That's Viper Energy, VNOM. Look, the other stocks that I bought, they're up 30, 40 to 50%. Viper's up about 9%. Why is that one lagging so much?
Well, Viper is a subsidiary of Diamondback Energy. They control the company and they are drilling on their minerals. Because Diamondback actually gets some of the dividends that Viper pays out, you know, they want to get those wells on their stuff online. But anyway, so Viper is in a category called the minerals companies, or you guys call them royalty companies. They don't have any drilling risk. They're really primarily a growth company. I have them in our high yield dividend company. Now, they have publicly told the market on their last conference call that they are very close to reaching their debt reduction target. They sold some non-core assets for $670 million in February. They used that to pay down debt. The balance sheet's in really good shape now. And they said their goal is to start paying out 100% of their free cash flow in the form of dividends and stock buybacks. And based on my forecast, their dividends should probably double next year. So see, I think when people are looking to invest for dividends and they look, you know, at these charts, they say, what kind of dividend? They're looking backwards. You know, they're looking at what are the dividends they paid in the last, you know, a year. And you got to look at, you got to understand what their policy is and then look forward. And, you know, no dividends are guaranteed. So until they start announcing the actual dividends going up, it's still going to show what they paid previously, not what they're going to pay forward. But I think it will. And it's a great growth company, man. It's really looked strong. They closed three really big deals in the last couple of years. We have four minerals companies in our high yield portfolio, and it is larger than the other three put together. So it looks really good. And Diamondback looks really good. Diamondback's one of the ones in our Sweet 16 that has the most leverage to oil.
Well, and Dan, I should also disclose I'm a shareholder as well of Viper Energy. And what I liked was also the takeover of Sitio Royalties. So that was another minerals company they absorbed. I don't think the market even understood that transaction or gave them any value for it. They barely moved on the back of it. And hasn't it been the case that they really haven't reported enough quarters in a row to really show what the combined... I mean, I know that happened last year, but it seems like the market's asleep on what that brought into the stable.
Yeah, whenever you have companies do these really significant transactions, that was a big one, no doubt about it. Until they report a full quarter of results combined, a lot of the analysts, I say they're too lazy. They're too lazy to actually go in and, you know, do the pro forma, even though they can, you know, look at somebody else's, I guess. But they want to see a full quarter of combined results before they make that kind of commitment, especially the generalist analysts, the guys that are not just, you know, pure energy sector analysts. But it looks really good. I mean, it's a rock solid company with a tremendous future. You know, what they sold, the Sitio, what they sold was the mineral interest outside of the Permian Basin. And that Sitio had a bunch of that. So they're a pure Permian Basin company, and they've got thousands of wells are going to be completed on their minerals in the next year. I think they estimated like 1,300 new wells are being drilled on their minerals this year.
So following up on your thoughts that they're going to be raising their dividends, as oil was moving down, we were getting a lot of questions asking how sustainable these dividends are. Now, because the oil price is higher, and if it stays higher, what is the play in terms of finding stocks that will increase their dividends?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at them, some of them are actually tell the market they pay variable dividends. So you can kind of tell. Some of them have a base dividend and a variable dividend. Who was I looking at the other day? Anyway, and so the variable, and they usually have a formula in there how they do it. So yeah, people that invest for dividends, they hate to see the dividends go down. Of course, if the oil price goes up and they have a bigger dividend or a special dividend, like Hemisphere every once in a while has a special dividend, they really like that. So.
Yeah, people love the special dividends because it's usually gravy on top. But the other question is, with these higher prices, we're getting a lot of questions about how companies are hedging. Now, some companies were already hedged quite a bit going into this, and they didn't benefit from the big spike up as much as they could have as, like, let's say, an unhedged company. But are there any companies that stand out to you that have a good hedge book, or they're taking advantage of it now that there's the higher prices and locking that in?
Yeah, and I show the impact of hedges on the bottom of all my forecast models. And I did talk to Surge Energy, a Canadian that's in our high yield income portfolio, which I really like, by the way. My valuation is about double what the share price is right now. They pay a really nice dividend. But they they told me that they are going to, on days when it spikes up, they're going to hedge forward like a month. Now, when the strip is this backward dated, now, for the next 5 or 6 months, they could lock in $80 oil if they wanted to, just hedge everything with the future strip. And so they could do that. A lot of them haven't said, it's not something they broadcast every day what they're going to do, but Surge did. But some of them do have quite a bit of their production. Now, the ones I'm listed, I sent you a note. I said, here are the ones that have the most exposure to oil prices, up or down. EOG Resources, super big company, the biggest company in our sweet 16. It is totally unhedged on oil. Diamondback Energy, all they have is some puts in place that protect their downside, but they retain all of the upside. And so does Viper. Viper has a lot of upside exposure to oil price. Matador Resources, Magnolia, which is a little one, MGY, I put on that note. It's Magnolia Oil and Gas. They have never hedged. They don't hedge any of their production, and they lock in. They pay out a high percentage of their cash flow. And Permian Resources, PR, those are the ones that look really good to me. For just if you're wanting to add more exposure to oil prices, these are the ones. And they have not fully. They're not fully priced in. The stocks are prices if oil is going to stay at 90 or something.
So, Dan, if you break down the different portfolios that you share with your subscribers, one being focused on the big guys, one being focused on growth, one being focused on income, overall, which ones have the best torque in this sort of environment?
Well, it's kind of, you look at the individual stocks, I guess. But yeah, some of the small caps, because, size does matter in this business. And of course, if you're a big money manager, big fund, and you're going to move billions into stuff, you want to move it into the large caps because, you won't have the ability to get out if it goes the reverse. They don't have the trading volume. But, some of our biggest gains that we've harvested are be some of these small ones. This morning, I was looking at Ring Energy. It's like the leading stock in our small cap growth portfolio. And it's just a little boring conventional oil. They're in the Central Basin Platform. It's up 79% year to date and with almost no news at all. And most of that 79% gain came before the war started. It's moved up a little bit since the war started. But I looked at their year-end reserve report and the stock is trading at less than 50% of the PV10 net asset value of just their proved reserves, and they have 500 more development drilling locations. So you're getting all of that development upside for free on a stock like that. Now, they don't pay a dividend, and they keep telling the market they're going to use free cash flow to pay down debt, and they have generated free cash flow for 25 straight quarters. So that's one to look at. Now, I do like, we mentioned on this before, in-play oil, I really like it. Hemisphere's 100% oil play, pays a nice dividend, and it just announced another special dividend the other day, and that one looks good. But, just within the portfolio itself, like I have, four or five companies that I call gassers, that they get most of their revenues from selling natural gas. Now they're probably in the short term, don't have a lot of upside. But when Golden Pass comes online, and if we, have a hot summer that creates more gas demand for power generation, these companies are going to draw a lot of attention. And, overall, and maybe it's because, you know, natural gas is labeled the clean fossil fuel is natural gas. So you don't feel you can sleep at night, I guess, if you're an environmentalist, if you invest in natural gas stocks. But they made a lot of money last year when gas was like three. And if gas just goes to 350 or four, which I think it's definitely going to do in the second half of this year, then they're going to get a lot of attention from generalist investors, I think. So we'll see. They're all good. I mean, I think the worst performing stock in our Sweet 16 is up like 20%.
Well, Dan, just to the point you made about Ring Energy, how it had mostly moved before the war started, you could say that about the vast majority of the energy sector. Like, if you looked at the charts of XLE, we were astonished that when oil was in the high 50s and low 60s, that XLE was breaking higher and higher. So most of those stocks made the move before we ever saw $70, $80, or $90, or $100 oil prices over the last month or two. So what do you make of the disconnect where all of the action that happened before, was it all front-running the conflict, or is there still more catch-up to happen if these prices stay elevated for longer?
Well, you know, sometimes on these little companies, because Ring only has a market cap of like $300 million, it's considered a pretty small company. And it just takes, you know, one big heavy hitter fund to discover them. And I see that happen on a lot of these little companies. They'll be running some screens to look at small caps, and they come across this one and say, man, this stock's trading for half of its PV10 value based on a third-party reserve report. That makes no sense. And they start looking at it. They go, shit, these guys have been free cash flow for 24 straight quarters. What am I missing? And then they keep looking, and you're not missing anything. It's just grossly undervalued. And they go, I mean, remember when Calibre took off because they announced like a couple really good wells? And it looks good, by the way. They still haven't gotten their fourth quarter results, but they put out an operation update that looked pretty good. Spartan Delta and Journey Energy were the two top performing stocks last year. Spartan Delta doesn't pay dividends, and it was outspending its cash flow. But guess what? It was reporting some of the best Duvernay shale wells I've ever seen. You know, quarter after quarter, it's reporting these monster wells coming online. Well, that draws a lot of attention, and that's what makes them go up. And then Journey is a 30% partner in the Duvernay oil play that's operated by Spartan. And so they're just along for the ride. And they, you know, had a great year last year, up, I think, 80%. Then Baytex is one we had in there. And then Baytex announces that sale. They sell all their Texas assets for $3 billion that pays off all their debt. They have a pristine balance sheet now, and they have a lot of running room up in Western Canada. So they're all, you know, they're unique situations. And, you know, that's my job. My job here is to find the ones that do have a unique situation, and they have catalysts in the near term that'll, you know, draw some attention from somebody. But if the overall market gains confidence in where the oil price is going to end up, and, you know, you got the guys on Fox and whatever every night saying, oh, this is just transitory. The gasoline prices are going to come down, blah, 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 blah. Well, you know, they want the Republicans to win the, you know, the midterm elections. That's why they're saying it. But what if it doesn't? I mean, what if it stays at 80 or 90 and gasoline stays at $1.50 a gallon higher? Then these companies are going to make a ton of money. So it's just a value thing change, but it's perception of the market at some time.
Okay, Dan, I'm going to ask you about a couple other, I guess, areas within the oil sector, one being oil services and one being offshore drillers. These haven't seemed to move as much. And we had somebody recently saying that they really like the fact that these were kind of a hated or unloved sector. What do you think about services or offshore drillers?
Well, you know, and I think we talked about it before, the Permian Basin is pretty much peaked. We've drilled like 85% of the good drilling location, the tier one area of the Permian. And, you know, drill baby drill is not going to rescue Trump this time. They're not going to go out there, even if oil goes to 70, they're going to use that extra money to, you know, pay higher dividends, buy back their stock or whatever. They're almost all their good acreage is held by production. They don't need to go do that. And, you know, the management of those companies is not going to go out and lead the pack. Hey, let's go drill a bunch of wells so Trump can have lower oil prices and we can not make money. I mean, these are public companies and their management team is there to make money for their shareholders. So they're not going to do it. Now, you bring up the offshore drillers. This world has to start developing stuff offshore. That's where the big reserves are in future oil supplies. And if the shale plays go flat and oil demand keeps going up a million, million and a half, 2 million barrels a day like it has for decades, you're going to have to go find new reserves, you know. And think about it this way. Of all the oil wells producing right now, and it's, you know, 100 million barrels a day or whatever, 50, 60, 70% of that production is going to be gone. So we have to keep drilling new wells just to replace the decline of the old wells. And then you've got to find new supplies in unknown areas, and that's offshore Africa, or maybe go up into, you know, Prudhoe Bay again or something, you know, Alaska. Well, those projects are long-term projects that do not get started if you have a perception that oil is going to stay in the 40s or 50s. So the perception that we're going to have higher prices, we've run out of $50 oil. There's not much $50 oil left. So you just have to keep coming up. I get asked that question, are we ever going to run out of oil? I said, we ran out of $10 oil, then $20 oil, then $30 oil, and we're just going to keep moving up that curve, and it's just going to keep being more expensive. Which is another reason why you can be bullish on natural gas, because natural gas can be used as a transportation fuel. And if oil gets super expensive, let's say oil does go to 120 or 30 and stays there, then you'll get trucking companies really looking to transition over to run on, you know, compressed natural gas or liquefied natural gas or something. And that's being done in China, actually.
Well, Dan, just one more thing to work into the energy sector here, and that's M&A deals. We've talked about a few of them, and you have a couple special situation stocks, which we've highlighted before, things like Devon, SM Energy, Crescent Energy. Aren't they in a similar boat, is my question, to what we talked about with Viper Energy, where it's just that the market and analyst initially didn't understand the deal, or maybe they didn't really like the company they were taking over. You know, Crescent was taken over Vital, and Vital had some room to improve. And Civitas is being taken over by SM Energy, same kind of pattern. Now, Coterra is a pretty good company that Devon's taken over, but all three of those seem like they're in a digestion process right now. How are you reading those special situation stocks?
Yeah, that is exactly the case. And the good thing, and I was able to build pro forma models on these because I covered both companies involved in a merger in each of those three cases. So I've been covering Vital for 5 years and Crescent for actually 2 or 3 years. And so it was really easy for me just to merge those models. And Vital had a reputation of kind of over-promising and under-delivering on their guidance. And that never gets you favor with the Wall Street gang, right? People that manage big money hate when you do that because it makes them look bad. But Crescent Energy looks really good. Now, here's the way I look at it. When those deals are first announced, there's always a reaction that the buyer paid too much. And, you know, most of these times, these big mergers, they're just individually negotiated deals. And all these deals were stock for stock deals. They were not like the buyer did not go into deep debt to make the deal. So Crescent Energy closed on December 15th. They closed the merger of Vital merged into Crescent Energy. So Crescent Energy, symbol CRGY, is going to report. The first quarter will be the first quarter of combined results. And a lot of the energy analysts are just generalist analysts especially. They will not look at these special situations until they get a full quarter of combined results and then real detailed guidance for the company. So Crescent has told me that when they release first quarter results, that's what they're going to do. They're going to get very detailed guidance for the rest of this year. And of course, you know, that'll be in, you know, early May. And they will also have a much clearer view of where the war is going and how much that's impacting oil prices. So, well, think of it this way. When they announced that deal and even when they closed that deal, oil prices were a lot lower. And the Vital is primarily an oil company. Crescent was more of a balanced company with oil and gas, or an Eagleford company. But they have three core areas now with the Permian Basin, South Texas, Eagleford, and I think they're the second largest producer in the Eagleford, which has a direct access to the LNG exporters also. And then Uinta Basin, which doesn't get the attention it deserves, very strong wells in the Uinta Basin. So that's one that I think has got like 60 or 70% upsides from where it trades around. And by the way, they were paying a really nice dividend before that. And that was one of the things that the Vital shareholders, they were screaming at Vital to start paying dividends. And then Crescent promised them they're gonna keep paying their dividends, and they're definitely sustainable with the cash flow they have now. Now the next one, and the one that I think is just beginning to get the attention it deserves, is the merger of Civitas is merging into SM Energy. That deal closed on January the 30th. So it has closed. There's no risk that it won't close. And so their first quarter results and their guidance would be, again, the first time the analysts really see it. And just recently, I looked at both Crescent and SM. Just recently, they're getting more analysts increasing their price targets. And they're all above the current share price, and they're all got buy recommendations on these stocks. Now, the biggest one, the big kahuna, is Coterra merging into Devon Energy. Those are both very large companies. Devon, when it closes this deal, will be bigger than Crescent and SM put together. Let's just say that. 1.6 million BOE per day, 800,000 or 900,000 barrels, almost 1 million barrels a day, I think, oil production. They're probably the number one company in the Delaware Basin, which is considered the better part of the Permian Basin. The Delaware Basin is the western half of the Permian, and the Midland Basin is the eastern half. But they're companies are reporting great wells in the Delaware Basin. So all three of those, with some special situation deals, and you know, I've been doing this, you know, EPG for over 20 years, and 9 times out of 10, these big mergers, when they close, and if especially if the oil and gas prices move up at the same time, they really make a jump after they have a quarter or two of combined results. So.
All right, Dan, we'll wrap it up here. Again, Dan Steffens, president of the Energy Prospectus Group. Always great getting your insights on the energy sector. And for all our listeners, you can click on that link in the show notes on our website or on your podcast player or on YouTube. Just search The KE Report. That's where you can follow around with Dan at the Energy Prospectus Group. Everyone, thanks for tuning in to this weekend show. I hope you all found it valuable, and please be sure to go back through our website, podcast, and YouTube channel to check out all our daily editorials and company updates from throughout the week, and be sure to stay in touch with Shad and I. Have a great rest of your weekend, everyone.
The Corlin Economics Report is produced for A.B. Corlin and Associates. Opinions expressed on this program are intended solely for the entertainment of our listeners, do not constitute investment advice, and are not necessarily those of this network, radio station, or our sponsors. Find out more about this program and today's guests by visiting www.kereport.com. For Al Corlin, this is Colleen Robbins. Join us again next week for the Corlin Economics Report.